Hi everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the UK Money Podcast. My name's Jason Mountford. I'm an ex-financial advisor, and on this show, my aim, my number one goal, is to help you use money as a tool to live the life you want to live. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. Whether we're talking about investments, whether we're talking about tax strategies, tax wrappers, whether we're talking about retirement accounts, whether we're talking about politics, kind of as it relates to personal finance, like the whole reason money is such an important topic and such an emotive topic for all of us is because it is the tool in which that shapes the way our life goes. Money gives you freedom to choose what you want to do. It gives you opportunities. It gives you flexibility to go after what you want to go after. So knowing all those bits and bobs and details and nuts and bolts of how the whole system works can really make you have a better life, as maybe trite as that sound. But anyway, I've got a couple of things I wanted to talk about today. I'm going to be answering a few listener questions as always. But the first thing I wanted to get into was to talk a little bit about the state pension. We see a lot of talk around the state pension kind of all the time. It's a very emotive topic. People get very passionate about it, especially those who are on the state pension. So we see a lot of coverage in the media around that sort of thing. And there's some real misconceptions around how it's calculated. And I think this is going to heat up, especially coming up to the election. And the reason for that is because the people who are receiving the state pension are pretty much the biggest voting bloc we've got. You know, politicians do not want to piss off the grey vote, as is known. And so you get politicians of both sides really kind of kissing the ass of people who are pensioners. And I'm not ragging on pensioners. I know that there's plenty of poor old biddies out there who need every penny they can get. But there are also a lot of millionaires. I think 25% of pensioners are millionaires. Yes, a lot of that is in property, but who cares? They've got a lot of money, a lot of assets. And so I think it's worth talking about how the state pension actually works. Because the misconception is that the state pension is a pot that you pay into, just like you'd pay into that personal pension or your workplace pension and defined benefit pension. Money comes from your pocket during working age, during your working life. That's then invested for you, and then it gets returned to you either as a pot that you can kind of manage yourself in a defined contribution scheme, or in the form of a regular income from a defined benefit scheme. The state pension does not work like that. The state pension, there is no pot, there is no big wad of cash sitting there. The government's just taking ATM withdrawals or cash machine withdrawals every week or fortnight or whatever it is to pay people who are on the state pension. The state pension is being paid by you and me. Our national insurance contributions go straight across the table to our grandparents. And the problem with that is that people who are of state pension age, that retired age group, is the fastest growing demographic. The fastest growing demographic of all of them. There is no group of people that the numbers are increasing by that much, which means there are fewer and fewer workers available to pay national insurance contributions as there are people who are needing the state pension. And there's a lot of talk always about like benefit cheats and, you know, people who are dull bludgers and all this sort of stuff. But actually, if you look at the statistics, the state pension is by far the biggest component of total benefit spend in the UK. And I looked it up just before, and I've now closed the window. But the total spending, state pension, it was 11.7% of total government spending. So almost 12p out of every pound that the government spends on everything, like that's NHS, that's defense, that's roads, that's all the money that goes to the councils, that's everything, all that money, 12% of that goes to paying state pension. So it's a massive component of where all of our money goes. And like I say, a lot of that is going to people that don't need it. You know, I talk a lot about means testing the state pension. I'm quite passionate about that because, you know, Alan Sugar gets a state pension. Gary Lineker, I don't know how old he is, but he looks pretty old. No, he's not state pension age. That's been really unfair to Gary. But when the time comes, Gary Lineker will get the state pension. And so when we talk about, you know, increasing the state pension, whether that's a triple lock or, you know, I saw an article before a couple of days ago, which was a pensioner aged 90 who was saying that it feels unfair that she's being taxed on her state pension. It feels like it's being double dipped and it's really hard for pensioners. Well, sorry, but I kind of call bullshit on that, because I think that it's actually very, very fair, because somebody who has, sure, worked plenty of times, probably paid into a state pension, paid into national insurance for, you know, a reasonable amount of time. You know, there has to be some grown-up conversations around what is affordable for the country, because the reality of it is that the money that is paid to pensioners will be, that if there is an increase to that, or if that continues to grow naturally as there are more people who are living longer in retirement, then that is money that is not going to other areas of the economy that I think need it more. So when we start to hear these conversations around the state pension, around paying into a pot, and there's definitely going to be some emotive discussion around this as we come up into the next election. Just keep in mind that, you know, that is how it works. It comes out of one hand and goes into another. And I think from a personal finance standpoint, it's also worth thinking about how that impacts you. If you're a long way away from retirement age, this is a demographic problem that is going to continue to get worse and worse. It's not just the UK, you know, pretty much every developed nation in the world is dealing with this, some even worse than us. And so you need to think about whether the state pension is necessarily going to be there for you. You need to think about if it's not going to be there for you, are you putting enough aside to still be able to live the retirement that you want to live without relying on money from the government that may not be there or may not be there in the way that it is today. So I just wanted to flag that up, because it was, like I say, I read that article the other day, and I wanted to make sure I covered it in here. But let's jump into the question. So I've got a question, or an email from Dan. He's actually got a couple of questions, and I want to touch on two of them. The first question he's asked is, the thing I'm struggling with the most right now is trying to figure out what to do with that, with some money that I want to put aside for about three years, so a bit less than the usual investing time frame. So from my perspective, 3 years is, it's not really long enough to invest. You know, even if you're investing in a fairly conservative portfolio that's heavily invested in bonds, we can see that the bond market's not immune to volatility. The last few years has shown us that. Now, a big part of that was because rates went up so much, so we're probably not going to see that same problem. But even so, I think any form of investment, really, you've got to be really, really careful with a three-year time frame. The one caveat to that, or exception to that, would be is if that three-year time frame is not like a set-in-stone time frame. So you said about 3 years. So, you know, if it was the case that you really want to maximize this money for a particular purpose, and ideally you'd like to have it available in 3 years, but if it was five, it's not like the end of the world, then you could maybe consider, you know, looking at a relatively sort of balanced or conservative approach to a portfolio to aim for a bit of additional return. But I think it's also worth considering that depending on the amount of money, you know, bank interest rates are still pretty decent. You know, you can get 4, 5, 6% even for a longer term fixed deposit. And with inflation around 3% on its way down, you know, that's a 3%, maybe 3.5% real return that you could be getting on that money, which is not shabby at all. And so, you know, for the risk return trade-off, like, yeah, okay, maybe you might get 8 or 9% if it's a decent period over the next 3 years. But, you know, is that risk premium worth it to you for the potential that you it doesn't go that well and you have less than you started, or, you know, a lesser number at the end than you would have if you just stuck it in the bank. So yeah, that would be my take. Probably keep it on the conservative side, accept the fact you're not going to get a lot of return on the money, take the interest, just sleep at night, really. Worth mentioning as well is premium bonds. A lot of clients in my experience love premium bonds. You know, only put up to, I think, 50 grand in there, but you've always got the chance you could win the big one. I've never had any of my clients win the £1 million, but there was a client that was at the firm that I was, one of the firms I was at, who did. So it does happen. It is possible. But don't have that as the cornerstone of your financial planning strategy. But yeah, that would be my take on that. And then Dan's other part of the question was that he said, I'm also trying to figure out how to plan financially for my baby daughter's future, which is a really good question. And the first place that people tend to jump with this one is to junior ISA. They think, that's the way to go. That's the ISA for kids. So I'm just going to do that. But there's one really big problem with that. And that is that your child becomes the legal owner of those assets the day they turn 18. Now, I guess you could hide it from them. If they don't know they have that account, then they don't know to access the money, I guess. But that's a little shady, and it's probably probably ways for them to find out. But anyway, so I don't suggest that, because we don't know what our kids are going to be like when they turn 18. A lot of them are going to be really, really responsible, and they would spend the money on kind of what you had envisaged, whether that's a home deposit or university costs or whatever. But there are plenty of kids who don't have their shit together when they're 17. I can tell you, if I got my hand on 20 grand, 50 grand, whatever, when I was 18, it would not have gone on sensible things. And so that, to me, kind of negates the generally what the purpose is behind saving for your kids' future. The idea is to put them on a kind of, give them a head start in life, put them in a position where they can, you know, not be behind the eight ball when they first go out into the world. So there are a couple of options that you've got. One of my favorite ones is to just use an ISA in your own name. You know, the combined ISA allowance for a couple is 40 grand. Most people aren't going to be maxing that out. 40 grand is a lot of money to be putting aside every single year in investments, and most people won't be doing that. So if you want to just put aside a couple hundred quid a month, then you could set up an ISA in your name. You can set it up with a different company now. You don't have to just pay into one ISA type every year. They've changed the rules on that. So you could have a separate one, which was kind of designated as your kid's ISA, pay into that. And then when the time comes, number one, it doesn't have to be 18. You might decide in your own mind that, well, I don't really want them to have it until they're 25 at least. So, you know, you could retain control over those funds, and you can have a discussion about it with them when the time comes. And, you know, even if you want to really retain control, you don't even have to give the money to them. You could pay it directly to whatever you agree that money should be spent on, and kind of treat it as a quasi trust fund. So it gives you a lot more flexibility and control over the funds, and still retains the tax benefits of the ISA wrapper. So I think that's a really good option. The other thing I always mention when we're talking about investing for kids is the fact that you can invest in a personal pension for your child. A newborn can have a pension fund, which I know sounds a little weird, but they can. They can put up to the minimum in that, which is £2,880 a year, and they automatically get tax relief on that of £720. So if you put the max in, you automatically get an extra £720 from the government in tax relief. Even though an 18-month-old is not working down the mines, they're not earning any money, they're not paying any tax, but they still get the tax relief, which is pretty awesome. And then so you've got that benefit, and that really has some massive impacts in terms of just the funds that are available. Excuse me. But the side benefit of that is, well, not the side benefit, but the real benefit to that, the core benefit, is the amount of time then that money has to compound. You know, if you put money into a pension fund for a newborn, you pay until they're 10, for example, then that's got like 55 years or more to compound. So even a relatively modest amount of money can add up to like a pretty eye-watering amount of money by the time they hit 65. And, you know, we're talking like millions, into the multiple millions of pounds. And so it's really worth thinking about. And the reason why I love it is because, number one, I mean, you know, you can't really set up your kid any better than that unless you're already a multimillionaire. You know, you're literally providing them a comfortable retirement, like, done. So that's obviously great for their financial future, but it's also really good for their, potentially really good for their working life as well. You know, I think a lot of us, you know, we end up going into careers and jobs and you know, lines of work that we definitely choose, at least in part, due to the financial aspects of it. Even if we're not necessarily passionate about it. And if, you know, if you can sit down and have that grown-up discussion with your kid once they're starting to think about the GCSEs and, you know, what they want to do when they grow up and all that sort of stuff, you know, you open up a lot more options for them. You know, like, I'm big into sport. I was always big into sport as a kid. And, you know, unless you're really the best of the best, there's not a lot of money in sport in general. And so that's the case for a lot of people. You know, they would maybe love to work around sport, especially for women who are fantastic at sport. Unfortunately, it's at the moment still doesn't pay that great. Other than sort of the really select few, even, you know, professional footballers don't get paid a lot most of the time. But if you can sort of say, look, we've set you up so that your retirement is covered, you know, that takes a massive weight off what they want to do with their life. And again, that could be a good thing or a bad thing. If you've got a child who's not very motivated and just wants to think, oh, fuck it, I'm sweet now, I can just doss about and I'll still have a good retirement, that's not necessarily great. But again, you're the parent, you'll know the best way to have this conversation. But it gives you more options at the end of the day. It gives more options of how you have that conversation. It gives more options of what your kid might want to do with their life if they know that retirement planning isn't something that they have to think about. So they're my go-tos when it comes to this topic. And I hope that's useful. So next, I want to cover a question that I've had from one of the listeners, as I mentioned earlier, from Gary. And Gary says, I am 56 and have zero pension. I'm just starting to be in a position where I can start to invest about £400 a month. I realize it's not much and won't make me financially secure when I retire, but I would like to put it to good use. Do you have any suggestions on where to invest? So this is a situation that is... it's a bit tough. Like, let's be honest, it means that, you know, Gary's got a really probably a limited time to be able to build up his retirement reserves. And as we all know, the state pension is, you know, it's not a significant amount, but that doesn't mean there's nothing he can do. And actually, I think Gary would be surprised at how much he will be able to generate in a pension before he reaches retirement, because $400 a month is a decent chunk of change, right? That's almost $5,000 a year. And so I guess there's a few things to think about. Number one would be, think about your retirement age. So when you are coming up to retirement age, everyone sort of tends to think about retirement age as the state pension age, which is fine. If you want to retire then, if you can afford to retire then you can, obviously. But you don't have to. And actually, if you are prepared or happy to continue in work in some capacity past your state pension age, that can have a really massive impact on your how comfortable you are financially throughout the rest of your life. Number one, because it gives you more years to obviously earn money and put money away. But also, every year that you are generating an income to pay for your lifestyle is one less income you're going to have to rely on your savings and pensions and things to pay for that. You can also consider, you know, what retirement looks like for you. So again, we often have this idea of retirement as being like, you finish 65, you get your gold watch, you put your feet up, and that's you done for the rest of your life. You're not doing a scrap of work. You know, the whole day is going to be, the whole week is going to be spent on the golf course or, you know, in the garden or whatever. But it doesn't have to be like that. And a lot of people now, and definitely think a lot of people around my age, are probably considering that they won't retire fully for a long time. And that doesn't have to mean, you know, doing backbreaking work or doing, you know, continuing to climb the corporate ladder or anything like that. But there are tons of options that you can take that can bring in a little bit of income, whether that's working a day a week, couple of days a week, that again helps, because it keeps that little bit of money trickling in. So that means you're not having to take as much from your pension assets or your investment assets. But it also, I think, provides a lot of side benefit to that as well. You know, it means that you're out there and meeting people, which is, you know, fantastic for your mental health and your physical health. You're getting out of the house, you're doing stuff, you're keeping your mind active. And of course, those days when you're working when you're working, you're not spending money, right? So I don't know about you guys, but I find that, you know, whenever I have a week off, even if I don't go anywhere, I spend a lot more money, because rather than, you know, working for 8 hours a day, I got to fill that 8 hours with something else. And yeah, a lot of the time that's, you know, stuff at home that doesn't cost any money, but also it's sort of much easier to, you know, say to the family, should we pop out for lunch, or, you know, should we go to the cinema? And, you know, when you've got couple of kids and, you know, there's two adults, all of a sudden, like, a simple trip to the cinema will cost you, you know, 50 quid or more. So that's kind of, I think it's important for all of us really to start thinking about retirement in a more broad sense. But when it comes to the specific question of where should he invest, I think the number one thing that Gary needs to think about is, what is his time frame? So when does he want to retire? Because, you know, if he wants to retire at 65, then he's got, you know, 9 years to invest. If he's happy to keep working until 70, he's got a bit longer. And that's really important when you're trying to maximize the amount of money you have at the end, right? So he's got that £400 a month to put away into an investment. You definitely want to consider the tax implications of that. So it's well worth considering using tax-free options. So, you know, with a pension, you gain access to the tax relief, but then when you do eventually hit retirement, then you may pay tax when you're withdrawing those funds. So there's got a bit of a pros and cons there. With an ISA, which this amount would be under the ISA allowance, which is £20,000 a year, you can put it in tax-free. You don't get the tax relief, but you don't have to pay tax on the withdrawals. So, you know, it's just, I guess, worth thinking about which of those would make more sense to you. You know, looking at your potential tax liability once you... pay tax at retirement age, at which point maybe looking at an ISA is a better option. So definitely think carefully about the tax wrapper you want to look at. And then within that tax wrapper, really it's about going as aggressive as you can handle whilst making sure the investments are sensible and stable. So when I say as aggressive as you can handle, this is not about putting everything in Bitcoin. This is not about putting everything on the, you know, high growth, super special Vietnam and Cambodia fund. Like, yes, those investments might do incredibly well over the next 10 years and you may turn, you know, a few grand into 50 grand, but it also could do very, very poorly. So this is that's not what you should stay, you should be looking at. But, you know, a time frame of 10 plus years is definitely a time frame where you could consider a portfolio that's 100% invested into the stock market. Again, that should be well diversified. You should spread that across international equities, especially the US. Have some UK in there. Have some of the smaller ones like Vietnam, Cambodia, China, India. You know, have a really good spread of equity markets. Really, the important thing is whether you can handle the fluctuations, because a 100% equity portfolio will fluctuate quite a lot. So you need to be prepared that, you know, if you're putting money in there for 3 years and it drops by 30%, how are you going to feel about that? Are you going to be able to maintain the investment strategy? Because where it really goes wrong is if you invest in that way and then when the markets drop significantly, you pull your money out. Because then you're really setting yourself up for failure. And actually, you know, if you're adding money on a regular basis, if you're adding a few hundred a month into it, when you see those drops, it's actually not a bad thing, because it means you're able to buy more at cheaper prices. When it comes to the specifics of where you invest, which app, which platform, that sort of thing, look, they're all much of a muchness as long as they're FCA regulated. All you need to really look at is what those underlying investments look like, what's the diversification level, and what are the fees. The fees are really the big one, especially on lower amounts of money. The fees can really dig into your return. Now, obviously, look at the percentage-based fees, so the fees for the underlying like fund holdings themselves, it should definitely be under 1%, like, and you can get it as low as 0.14%, I think, is the cheapest Vanguard one. So the actual fund management fees really should be under 0.5%, really. And then with account fees and everything like that, you should really be aiming for less than 1%. One thing I will definitely just suggest you keep really close on if you have lower amounts of money is a lot of these investment apps now have flat monthly fees. So they have a percentage-based fees on the investment, but then they'll have like another 2 quid a month for like an account keeping fee. And then they often add additional like premium fees for premium products or whatever, which gives you, I don't know what, but you know, stuff that doesn't really change your investment performance. But you've got to be really careful about that, because if you've got a lower amount of money, those monthly fees can be crazy, right? Like, so imagine it was, you had £100 to invest and there was a fee on there of like £1 a month. You might look at £1 a month and think, well, that's nothing. Like, that's absolutely fuck all. That's not going to make a difference to my portfolio. Well, okay, but £100, £1 a month is £12 a year. That's 12% fee, 12% account keeping fee. Like, that's crazy. So to get a return, you would need to earn 12% return just to break even, which is not going to happen. So yeah, that's what I would suggest. You just keep in mind in those flat fees, and pick a fund, any fund, or pick a platform, any platform, and then just be sensible about the funds you're investing in and making sure they're diversified. Hope that's useful. As I said, guys, I would love to hear your questions. If you have a question you would like answered on the show, just drop me a line at jason@jasonmountford.com. And if there's any feedback you have for me, anything else you'd like to hear, if you see a news story, then again, flick it over. I would love to hear from you. But look, in the meantime, I hope you all have a fantastic weekend. It's Friday now when I'm dropping this. Maybe you're listening on another day. But either way, I hope you have an awesome next week. And I will speak to you next week. It may not be Friday. I'm playing around a little bit with when I'm going to do these. To be honest, I don't think Friday is the best day for me to do this. So it may be Wednesday or Thursday next week. I'll see how we're getting on. But either way, once a week, you will definitely have an episode from me. Thanks, guys. Speak to you soon.